Good morning. The Hawaii Department of Health and the EPA have an agreement with the Navy. So why is the Hawaii Board of Water Supply concerned about Red Hill? We'll talk with Board Manager and Chief Engineer Ernest Lau. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Regardless of good intentions, do council and legislative resolutions mean anything, or do they just take precious time from lawmakers' work? We'll talk with Kauai County Council Chair Mel Raposo about the council's resolution to overturn Citizens United.
And the upcoming F808 Photo Hawaii is the first event of its kind in Hawaii, a day-long immersion in the photographer's art. We'll hear from Pacific New Media's David Ulrich. And the University of Texas Arlington Jazz Ensemble is in town as part of a jazz exchange program. We'll talk with band director Timothy Ishii.
That's the conversation for Tuesday, June 16th. Here's the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We've been hearing, how shall I put it, conflicting reports about the Red Hill fuel storage facility, yeah?
Yeah, and conflicting ways of assessing what that report means and what the agreement specifically will mean as we go forward.
Yeah.
Now, agreements often have their skeptics. One might be the recently announced deal by the EPA and the Hawaii Department of Health with the Navy to retrofit those fuel storage tanks at Red Hill. That plan includes a 2-year feasibility study for what likely will be a costly fix. The Navy will need to do the work over 2 years, or 20 years, I should say, or move the fuel storage facility elsewhere. Meanwhile, the Board of Water Supply is urging vigilance. The board's manager and chief engineer, Ernest Lau, joins us now to look at why. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you. Now, last Friday, we talked with Jared Blumenthal, the EPA Region 9 head. On the same day, the Star Advertiser had that headline, Board of Water Supply advises customers to be concerned. Is the Board of Water Supply wary of the Red Hill Agreement?
We are concerned, and we'll be making extensive suggestions on how to improve the agreement. We believe it's a good start. However, you know, there are opportunities to really improve it and make it even a stronger agreement that will ensure the safety of our water.
What would some of those improvements be?
For one example that's very obvious is I think the agreement should allow for greater participation and input into the process by both the public, our customers, and the Board of Water Supply.
They're going to be doing that feasibility study over the next 2 years. Would that be the appropriate time to feed into that with what you've just suggested?
Yes, Beth Ann, and actually, you know, we would welcome the opportunity to be more involved in that process and to keep our customers informed. However, there is a 30-day comment period, which we're a good ways through it right now. Comments are in the AOC and SLW are due July 1st to the Department of Health.
So people can still weigh in on that. But in terms of your involvement with the Board of Water Supply and to be able to be part of the process of that feasibility study, do you feel in any way that you haven't been brought into it nearly enough as you believe you should have?
I believe that, you know, we have been engaged at times, and we have been very, very upfront with both the Health Department and the EPA on our positions. So I think it's pretty clear where we stand on this. The regulatory process requires that the regulators, you know, participate with the owner of the facility, which in this case is the Navy and Defense Logistics Agency. So those are the ones who are actively involved. Because we're not a regulator of this process, we weren't directly involved in it.
But you do have responsibility for maintaining clean water and...
Well, yes, definitely. That's our mission. Safe, dependable, and affordable water for our community now and forever. And this facility overlies a drinking water aquifer that we also utilize to serve our customers. And it's of vital importance to us. This resource is irreplaceable. And we really are trying to urge vigilance and our customers get more involved in this process because we can't afford to lose this this aquifer to a massive contamination should that occur in the future.
Even though you don't have regulatory ability with the project, did the Department of Health and the EPA err in not involving you more?
During the regulatory process of development of the ALC and SOW, they didn't really involve us directly. We did participate extensively in the task force that was commissioned by the state legislature last year, which also involved the Department of Health and the U.S. EPA. So going forward in this process under the ALC and SOW, we'd ask that maybe a clear, transparent public involvement process be laid out in the ALC and SOW.
Does the public understand the issue well enough to be able to effectively comment? Do they have enough information?
Beth Ann, this is part of the challenge. The complexities of underground contamination and the movement of the groundwater are very difficult probably for the average person to understand, and that's why we at the Board of Water Supply, we feel we have a responsibility to bring whatever expertise is necessary to properly represent our customers, the public.
The Department of Health has told us since all of this came out that the groundwater wasn't threatened, that the way in which the fuel leak would be moving would be very different from where the groundwater lays. Is that true?
Beth, and I think this is maybe a point of disagreement with the Department of Health, maybe the EPA. The underground conditions in the basalt rock are very complex, and there really isn't enough actual data to actually say with any surety that there's no chance that contamination from this facility won't reach our wells.
So in part of that, you feel that's not part of the information that's gotten out to the public well enough?
I think more communication is better, and additional studies, drilling of monitor wells will help provide better information on what the underground conditions are. One of the things that we've been pushing since last year was a term called characterization. Characterization is simply trying to define the extent of the current contamination that's already existing under the facility and around the facility, determine better the underground conditions in the aquifer, in the basalt rock, so we can better model these and do additional studies. For the Board of Water Supply, we've also commissioned in partnership with the United States Geological Survey to do more groundwater modeling in the area.
When Jared Blumenthal was here on Friday, he also said that the EPA will continue to do testing and that the EPA's testing is considered to be the gold standard against which everything else is measured. The DOH will also do its own testing, too. Now you're saying you're doing testing as well. Obviously, that's a lot of testing. Is that going to be enough and networked well enough to be able to create a full picture in your mind of what is really happening with that fuel storage leak?
I think it'll be a good start, and it's good to have independent parties actually doing maybe some, you would consider maybe duplicative testing, because it ensures that the quality or accuracy of the data is there. We at the Board of Water Supply, we annually conduct over 30,000 tests of our drinking water to ensure its safety for our community. So we have a lot of experience testing water and working with certified laboratories as necessary to do that.
The time frame on this is a 2-year study, as we've been talking about, and then after that, over a 20-year period to be able to retrofit the tanks. Is that a time frame that you think is too long, too short?
Beth Ann, simply, let's put this in perspective. The facility was constructed between 1940 and 1943, and currently it's about 70-plus years old. If you add another 22 years on it, this facility will be 92 years, almost 100 years old, by the time the final improvements are in place. That is a concern, of course, because of the simple age of the facility.
That might argue for simply scrapping it and starting from scratch, particularly as costs will be escalating over that time period. There's also the option that the Navy may decide that it's too costly and simply tear down the facility and move it elsewhere. even if they do that, will there still be issues with the ground fuel that's already been leaking?
Yes, you know, that's one of our one of the things we advocate is actually, we know that there is contamination of the groundwater below the facility. Rock cores drilled out underneath the 20 tanks revealed that at least 19 of the tanks had petroleum staining of the rock, the basalt rock, which is a result of leaks from those tanks. So 19 of the 20 show evidence of leaks. So we feel that even if the facility is shut down, and that's a Navy decision, that they need to clean up the site, as any other owner of a contaminated site would be required to do.
They'll still have to mitigate all that damage. I wish we had more time to talk, but I thank you very much for being able to be with us this morning.
Oh, thank you, Beth Ann. A reminder about the Thursday, June 18th meeting at 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Mauna Loa Middle School, 1289 Mahi'ole Street in Mauna Loa.
All right.
It's a very important meeting.
We'll have that up on our Facebook page, and you said it. Now I don't have to. Thanks so much. Ernest Lau is the manager and chief engineer of the Board of Water Supply. His responsibilities include the overall strategic direction and management of the board, and he spent his career in water resource management. Again, we'll have all the details about the Thursday's meeting up on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:17. Coming up, keeping up with the ever-changing face of photography. Later in the hour, Kauai County's resolution to overturn Citizens United. But first, your backyard quiz.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we're taking a look at another of Hawaii's nasty invasive species. This one is found on the Hawaii State Noxious Weed List and is known to grow to heights of over 20 feet. Native to the Mediterranean, the species in question was introduced as a purely decorative piece of flora. Though the weed looks like sugarcane, its impact on the environment is much more menacing. The weeds tend to overcrowd and block out native vegetation, their thick growth reducing natural habitats for wildlife, and when they're dry, the weeds easily catch fire. The species we're referred to is commonly known as giant reed, but for today's quiz, we wanted to know if you could tell us the weed's scientific name. Give us a call at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. If you're first on the line to nail it, you'll win an HPR t-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, giving 60,000 hours of community service annually and recognized as a school of character by the Character Education Partnership. SacredHearts.org.
Hawaii offers a range of opportunity to the photographers who live and work here, and as a result has attracted skilled specialists in such aspects of the photographic art as underwater work, fashion and commercial photography, and pictorial work. There's a body of collective knowledge to be drawn upon here, and an upcoming symposium will bring it all together under one roof. David Ulrich is a coordinator, F808 Photo Hawaii, a day-long symposium weekend after next. He's with us this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Chris. How are you doing?
Pretty good. The first thing you think of in with Hawaii photography is obviously the beautiful pictorial work that you can get by going down to the beach when the sun is going down, and that's there for us almost every day.
Of course that is, and if you really look at the scene, the photographic scene in Hawaii, you're going to find certain areas that are quite thriving, if you will. One of them is surf photography.
Yes. Oh,
we have a large number of surf photographers doing extraordinary work. Some of it is world-class work.
Absolutely.
In fact, the second keynote speech at our F808 presentation of his work is Zach Noyle, mm-hmm. who's on the staff of Surfer Magazine and is traveling the world. I believe he's in Fiji now photographing one of the surf competitions.
With surf photography, it seems as if the, we've seen those spectacular images now for years, but they're getting more and more spectacular as the photographers are right in there next to them with incredibly high resolution. Every little drop of water is frozen. It's almost like an escalating of the level of the photography, yeah?
Yeah, the photographs are becoming so immediate because the photographers have water housings and GoPros, and they're not only in the water, they're in the wave.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And they're feeling the wave, they're along with the surfers, they're very close. So it takes both waterproof equipment and a certain degree of bravery.
Yeah, in fact, one of the moderators is my friend Hugh Gentry from he has to be very skilled in the water, just as a swimmer, as well as a photographer, just to get to the right place, right?
Exactly. Yes, and Hugh is the moderator of our photojournalism panel. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of talent in Hawaii, so the F808 is really much like Houston Photo Fest or Arles Photo Festival, where we're bringing together the best photographers in Hawaii, and we're putting them together to dialogue and putting them in front of the public.
Because with such specialized skills as surf photography, there's almost more than any one person can take on. You can't, in terms of knowing all the different disciplines, I mean, fashion photography has a whole level of skills that other kinds of photographers don't even address. You know?
Exactly. And then when you start looking at commercial photography or fine art photography or editorial, it's all very different.
Yeah.
And then if you add that to the mix, we now have mobile technology. So all of this is going to be covered in the festival. And we have, I think, some of the best representatives from these different areas. A couple of exciting people. P.F. Bentley, who formerly was a staff photographer for Civil Beat, was one of the chief photographers in the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. had unprecedented access to the president, Congress, and he lives on Molokai. We also have one of the creators of the app called Snapseed, which is one of the principal photo editing apps on an iPhone or Android. And another very exciting thing that we just worked out yesterday, much like the Sundance Film Festival, we're having a pop-up tintype photo booth at F808. So Chase Norton, a local photographer, is going to set up his portrait booth, take tintypes of people throughout the day, which will then be put up in the Halekulani Gallery. The conference, of course, is at Halekulani. And I would like to make a plug for the Halekulani as the venue and for their lunch.
Sure. Well, you know, all those different disciplines coming together under one roof. For one thing, part of it is that from last year to now, there's new resources available to the photographer. I mean, I'm thinking of the prevalence of the GoPro, which is now part of everyone's kit, just to get that shot that can't be gotten any other way. The fact that anybody can now shoot with an iPhone. iPhones are actually now being touted as ways, as fine art, means of delivering fine art photography.
Yeah, I think there's two major developments as I see it. One is new forms of equipment, and I think GoPro is a perfect example.
Yeah.
And the second is new ways of disseminating images like Instagram.
Well, with new technology that makes everything easier, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, it seems to me anyway, David, as you know, those of us who came up through the darkroom, the film, waiting for the film to be processed, and that forced a degree of attention to detail all along the line that is now bypassed by equipment.
Absolutely. However, there's one thing we have to remember. In 1889, Kodak introduced a small camera you could put in your purse, mm-hmm. and its tagline was, "You push the button, we do the rest."
I remember.
The snapshot has always been a major part of photography.
Sure.
So I think when you're dealing with a serious practitioner and coming up through the ranks in photography when you had a dark room and film, there was a discipline that was required.
Yeah.
But I would argue that that same discipline is equally true in the digital tools. That if you're going to do it well and you're going to do it seriously, you need to really give attention to learning your craft.
Yeah, you get a result easily, but you get a great result by putting some work into
exactly,
it,
exactly, right? Exactly. And, of course, that's why we're doing our F808, because we really want to bring photographers together. When we get together, we actually talk about many things. Art and life and photography, but also technique.
Yeah. Well, technique, it's changing so fast, we've got to keep talking about it, don't we, David?
Exactly, exactly.
Thanks very much for coming in. We look forward to that.
I would like to have people look at our website. It's f808photohawaii.com.
And we'll send people your way. David Ulrich is a coordinator of F808 Photo Hawaii, which is a day-long symposium. Runs all day Saturday, June 27th. At the Halekulani Hotel Ballroom, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Fail.
You know, if I was asked, I would definitely say that yes, I do consider myself to be black.
But she couldn't pass, and Rachel Dolezal's race pretense has cost her her job. But should it? Race is culture or skin color? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Two weighty decisions face the Board of Education today. The BOE will look at its policies on suspensions and sex education. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Well, these are, you know, two things that can affect families greatly, but let's talk about the sex ed part first, because part of that that's changing or could be changing is how a kid actually is able to get sex ed.
Right. So when back in April, Jessica Terrell, our reporter, she revealed the fact that we're one of only 10 states that do not mandate access to sexual education or teach about HIV and AIDS. And another alarming statistic is that we actually have the 10th highest teen pregnancy rate and also the 12th highest in chlamydia. So clearly there is a need to have this, but it's not mandated. So what the DOE, or rather the Board of Education, the BOE, will consider at their meeting today is to have a new policy that will recommend grades 7 through 12 that the parents of those students sign them up for sexual education. That's the current policy. That's the current proposed policy. Mm-hmm. An earlier draft got people upset because it would have automatically enrolled the students into the sex ed program, and then the parents would have to opt them out.
That may, in fact, you know, if the new policy goes through, leave some kids without sex education. You already mentioned some of the statistics
right.
that we look at here in the state. But with the Board of Education feeling perhaps that after all the brouhaha over Pono choices and some of the other issues over time about medically accurate sex education, that something is better than nothing. Is this the case?
Certainly social conservatives, I think Bob McDermott in the legislature, probably the most outspoken of this, and also a lot of parents concerned about, you know, that Pono choices went too far, that the information that was in there was not appropriate, and they were upset because the current DOE policy is an opt-in policy. So that upset people. But I think the bigger concern, the reality check, if you will, is that public schools are being asked to offer comprehensive, medically accurate sex education in certain grades. That's something that that I grew up with and many other people. And given that we have those high statistics, it seems like a very appropriate path.
And that would be at all of the schools, not necessarily just the ones who pick and choose what sex education they're going to be offering.
That's right. The decision right now is actually up to individual school administrators whether they want to offer that or not. This would actually make it mandatory.
All right. Now, before we stop talking about this for today, the other part of what they're going to be talking about is the issue of suspensions and using that as sort of, you know, the reprimand of last resort.
Right, exactly. If a student is suspended, the teachers or administrators would have to actually document that in writing. What they want to do is they want to promote a climate of respect, a safe environment for the students. That vote was delayed last month because administrators said they didn't feel like they were sufficiently involved. So two big topics on the Board of Education's plate this afternoon. Our Jessica Terrell will be at that meeting. It should be a good one.
And there may be some more stuff for us to talk about there, Chad. Thanks
exactly.
so much.
Exactly. Thanks, Bethann.
All right. We'll talk to you later, Chad. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Straub Clinic and Hospital, a proud healthcare partner of University of Hawaii Athletics. Learn more at straubhealth.org.
Two weeks ago, they thought it was a slam dunk. Unable to reach consensus, the Kauai County Council deferred a resolution to ask Hawaii's congressional delegation to challenge the Citizens United decision. Tomorrow, the council will again take up that discussion. Whatever happens with the draft resolution 2015-44, there's still the question of whether all the time, energy, and conversation being expended on a resolution is really worth it. Resolutions are usually expressions of opinions or calls for action, but aren't compulsory. Mel Raposo is the chair of the Kauai County Council, and he's on the line to talk with us about it. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
And thanks very much for making some time. I know that it was hard to squeeze in, but we appreciate it. So this particular resolution, everyone thought was going to be somewhat of an easy thing to do, and then there was a great deal of conversation. Why?
I assumed that it would have been a very quick discussion and vote. One of the council members had some issues with a couple of the paragraphs as it referenced corporations, and he believed that the verbiage inferred that corporations were bad or not good for the community. So he had problems with two paragraphs. So one of the co-sponsoring council members submit an amendment that would remove the two paragraphs, but the other co-sponsoring member had issues with it. So at the end of the day, we were missing one member. He was in an excused absence, so we only had six people, and it ended up it wouldn't have enough votes to pass. It would end up in a 3-3 tie, so it was just deferred, and we'll wait for the seventh member to come back next week.
All of what you've just talked about with the differences of opinion over something that you thought and several other people thought was going to be an easy run seems to also make the point that it's taking a lot of time that maybe might be better used elsewhere, particularly when you're talking about time to talk about a resolution. How do you answer that?
Well, I think, you know, resolutions are basically policy statements of the council. And You know, I think the discussion is valuable. I think in many cases, you know, I don't agree with all the resolutions that come forward. You know, unfortunately, and you know, I don't want to digress, but, you know, the Sunshine Law prohibits council members from discussing these types of issues before the meeting. So a lot of the time is spent because these amendments or discussions are being heard for the first time by council members. So that causes a problem in and of itself. So for the most part, you know, we're seeing the information for the first time and having an opportunity to discuss it. So, but, you know, is it a waste of time? I don't believe so. I think the community, these are usually community-driven, where members of the constituency will submit a request. And we accommodate that by allowing a forum where the community can come and testify.
When you talk about something as incredibly weighty as the Citizens United decision, and the idea that somehow a resolution that's not binding would have some impact in changing that, is that sort of leading people down the wrong path, or is it just giving them an opportunity to vent a great deal of frustration?
I think part of it is that. I think part of it, you know, it provides a forum for the activist organizations that are pushing the movement to give them a place that they can, you know, express their concerns. But it also informs and educates the public who, you know, if not for this resolution, if not for the public discussion, may not be aware of what is happening at the congressional level, at federal level. So, you know, I think it's a service. Not all resolutions. I mean, some resolutions are, you know, I would rather not spend the time on it, but I think that's, you know, that accounts for a very small number of them.
One of the biggest criticisms of resolutions is that they have no teeth, that there's nothing really to make them enforceable. For a lot of people who are particularly concerned over the Citizens United decision, does this give them, though, some way of being able to galvanize with larger organizations and to continue to put some more pressure for something that they believe strongly in?
I think so. I think, you know, they'll be able to utilize the resolution that has passed a city council or county council or a state legislative body and put that in their portfolio of information as they go around and continue their, you know, spreading the word. So, yeah, I think, no doubt, it does give some credence or credibility to their effort. And in this case, again, I think, you know, most of the general public were not aware of the Supreme Court's decision, and a lot of people that I spoke to on the street didn't even know that that the corporations were allowed to donate that kinds of money in federal elections. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, and it does inform and educate, and I think that's the purpose why we allow that to happen here.
I mean, part of this is that we're talking about a Supreme Court decision that came in 2010, and already that's now, you know, 5 years ago, and people tend to forget things pretty quickly. Is this revivifying that conversation? Are you seeing people actually understanding some of those issues any better because they're having these discussions with you?
Yeah, I think, you know, the two major points in this specific resolution was the decision or the ruling that, you know, corporations would be treated as people, as citizens, and the second part of it, I think, that raised some concern was the ruling that money was
free speech
free speech, and I think, you know, I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
So at this point, with or without the resolution, do you feel like there are more people in Kauai who are able to take the information and do something with it? And if so, what do you think their outlet should be?
Yeah, I think realistically, not much will come of the resolution other than sending it to all of our congressional leaders and state leaders and, you know, maybe hoping that the state will do the same thing. But as far as the people, you know, it'll get them active. I think most people realize that it's probably something that's not going to happen. But nonetheless, I mean, it informs the public and gives them an opportunity, if they choose to get on board with the movement and try to get this decision changed.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the time you gave us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mel Raposo is the chair of the Kauai County Council. He's also on the committee. He's also the committee chair for the Committee of the Whole and a member of the Budget and Finance Committee and president of the Hawaii State Association of Counties. Now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. Earlier in the show, we put the spotlight on an invasive plant that has been wreaking havoc on Hawaii's environment since it was introduced. Commonly known as giant reed, the plant can be found on the Hawaii State Noxious Weed List and is known to grow as tall as 20 feet or more in some cases. Originating in the Mediterranean, giant reed was introduced to Hawaii as a decorative piece of flora. And though the weeds appear to be a close cousin of sugarcane, their impact on the environment is much worse. The weeds tend to overcrowd and can block out native vegetation, and their thick growth reduces habitats for wildlife. And when dry, those plants can easily catch fire. For today's quiz, we asked if you could tell us what the scientific name is for giant reed, and the answer is Arundo Donax, and we had someone who knew that.
Yeah, somebody actually knew the answer. I'm impressed, Bethann.
Me too.
Tessa Bilardo of Kapa'a knew Arundo Donax, and so she's going to get an HPR t-shirt. Impressive. At 8:46, that's today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha and good morning. This is Professor Ashley Maynard. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Jazz education is now firmly in place across the country, and it has taken America's native art form from the barroom to the classroom. The intricacies of jazz, and there are many, are now passed along in an academic environment, and that has opened the doors to an expansion of the art, which is now worldwide. Tim Ishii is the band director for the University of Texas at Arlington. He's in town to perform and exchange ideas with student jazz musicians here. He's on hand this morning. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Chris.
Our lifetimes have seen a real change in the way jazz is brought to young musicians and the availability of information to young musicians, yeah?
Absolutely. Dating back to early jazz, you know, jazz was kind of a language that's passed down from, you know, person to person, generation to generation, mentorship, et cetera. You know, in modern day jazz education, you know, in academia, there's a lot of technical facility that's brought to the students and using all that knowledge. But, you know, we still want to maintain the true language of jazz. And, you know, basically what I try to do with our students at UT Arlington is to instill a sense of internalization. You know, we still go back and we really study hard all the concepts of jazz and styles, but through things like transcription, you know, the emulation and the copying of the jazz masters.
And when you transcribe a great Charlie Parker solo, you're looking at a moment of spontaneous invention. He wasn't reading anything, right? It just came right out of his head.
Correct. That was spontaneous, but through the meticulous emulation of that. We learn nuance, we learn tone to mm-hmm. match and imitate tone, and also internalize time feel, even taking the breath in the right place and
getting
that feeling inside our bodies. That's what's really important about improvising jazz.
Well, you know, up to the time jazz became something that was taught in schools, there was a very sort of, you could almost take any great jazz musician and he had contact at some point with antecedents who showed him, you know, Miles Davis played for Charlie Parker and then John Coltrane played with Miles Davis. There's, you know, everyone kind of links to everyone else in the history, yeah?
Absolutely. Modeling in this art form is so very important. So at UT Arlington, we have a fantastic jazz faculty, and we do a lot of modeling for our students. We perform concerts, recitals. And we also do something, too, which is not uncommon in the jazz tradition, and that is we ask our students to play alongside of us
mm-hmm.
so that they, you know, you feel that energy, that vibe, and the communication, you know, jazz being such a democratic music and everybody having a different role, but we're all creating on the spot and interacting with each other.
And it's kind of the ultimate democratic music in so many ways. And yet, you know, I've always been struck by this sort of the apparent contradiction of teaching as a method, something that was originally, you know, there was a lot of disapproval of Charlie Parker when he started out, a lot of disapproval of almost any great innovator, John Coltrane, Charles Mingus, all had their detractors when they first started out. You know, you have this process of going from the outside to the mainstream, right?
Yeah, you know, jazz has always been a music that's forward-looking.
Yeah.
You know, very, very innovative. And as you look at the periods of music, you know, classical, romantic, you know, these periods of music last anywhere from 50 years to 150 years,
mm-hmm.
sometimes longer. And in jazz, you'll kind of notice that there were these overlapping trends that we call periods in jazz, but they came very quickly, like, you know, even like 10 years at a time, if we want to put them in kind of a framework. But
yeah.
But forward looking, always learning from your mentors and integrating new ideas, borrowing, stealing, we'll say it, licks and things like that. So yeah, it's a very, very improvisational, groundbreaking music.
And I would think, keeping in mind that innovation doesn't always make everybody comfortable, you know, that a lot of the great artists that we cite as examples had to, you know, offended some people's ears when they first started. That's part of the whole thing of being forward-looking, yeah?
Yeah, innovation is always kind of a interesting thing. There's always new artists on the horizon, and especially they're getting younger. And because of this jazz education, that circling back to that topic, the music can come to the students so much faster. You know, even me only being about 52 years old, when I was in high school, I still had to go listen to LPs. And mm-hmm. and you listen to them over and over and over on your turntable.
Right.
Music is so accessible to young students these days via the internet, and so they can go out and search and find things instantly. And so the music progresses very quickly, and so I think we're seeing changes in jazz that are coming even faster than we can even imagine. You know, new things on the horizon every day almost.
One of the things I think that has opened up is now when I look at the scene, it's completely international. It is, you know, it used to be that the great jazz came from the U.S. and there were little pockets in Europe. There were artists like Django Reinhardt were outside of the mainstream, but it was essentially American, maybe up to the Second World War, and then it started to really. Now it's everywhere, isn't it?
Jazz is definitely global, and this exchange that we're doing, this Hawaii Jazz Exchange this week, this next couple weeks, involves students from the United States, also a teacher from Germany, and maybe a couple students are going to participate from Germany. And I have in my UT Arlington Jazz Orchestra, I have a student from Spain, and I have a student from Korea. And so it truly is an international and global music now. And, you know, to the point where even when we're recording this music, you can send files all over the world.
Yeah.
And you know, we can, you know, send a track somewhere and someone can put their music right onto your track. And so really it's just universal.
What do the students who come to you to learn how to play jazz, what do they tell you about what drew them to wanting to play this particular type of music. It's not for everybody, right? It's not the most popular music out there, certainly.
I think that the thing that draws them to it is the freedom. It's the freedom of expression, and that's always been jazz, the ability to improvise, the ability to try new things. And we're seeing in our program the proliferation of composition. I think that's the new medium that, you know, not only are they learning how to play the music technically, but they're creating their own music through composition, and we have a fantastic faculty that allows us to do that.
And that's a real advance, composing for jazz. Because, I mean, for a long time, jazz reworked popular songs, right?
Yeah. And
it still does.
We still do that. But one of the things in our program that we are really pushing is the creation of music. Because I personally think that that's the gateway for the jazz musician, the young aspiring jazz musician into the world, is that they have to not only play well, but they have to create their own music and put their own voice out there that way. And that's the way to do it so that it has some, substantiation.
And actually composing for the jazz idiom is a very different discipline than composing for practically any other. It's a whole different language, isn't it?
Oh, sure. You know, when they take, you know, traditional composition courses, they're gonna have lots of regulations and rules about certain voice leadings and things like that.
Yeah.
And jazz is a little more textural. You know, we want to see them break the rules. We want to see if we can make that work and how they bring their individual point of view.
It's got to be exciting. Thanks very much for coming in.
Had a great time here. Thank you.
Tim Ishii is the director of the University of Texas Arlington Jazz Ensemble, which is in town for a series of workshops and performances. And on Saturday, June 27th at 4 p.m., they'll be performing at Iolani School, right?
Correct.
At Iolani with the Iolani Stage Band, the UT Arlington Jazz Orchestra, and the International Jazz Collective. That's a free concert at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on that Saturday. You can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com. Blind Willie Johnson and Big Bill Brunzi, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. Hear the stories behind these names and the music that became known as the Delta and Chicago Blues. Rick Smith and the Trailer Park Romeos school you in all things blues in the Atherton Studio, Saturday, June 27th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours.
But then legislative bodies are fond of so-called resolutions, right, which express an intention but without the force of law.
And we talked a little bit about that with Kauai County Chair Mel Raposo just a little while ago. And he says it's not just, you know, doing something that has teeth, but trying to get the conversation going and to educate people. And for that, maybe it has a purpose.
Well, let's hope so.
We'll see. There will be plenty, plenty more in our future. That's for certain. Now, in your future tomorrow, if you're with us, and we hope you will, the man who patrolled the southern end of the Golden Gate Bridge. Maybe you heard his TED Talk last year. We're going to talk with Sergeant Kevin Briggs about preventing suicide.
And we'll talk tomorrow morning with Peter Yarrow, singer from the folk singing group Peter, Paul, and Mary. He's coming to town. We'll talk to him tomorrow morning.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can get to us on our talk back line at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And you can find past shows on the HPR2 archive. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right here for more of the conversation.